You are about to hear Mr. John Foster Dulles, Republican advisor to the Department of State and a member of the United States delegation to the United Nations. Mr. Dulles speaks tonight at a dinner meeting of the American Association for the United Nations. In this exclusive mutual broadcast which follows, Mr. Dulles will be introduced by Mr. Clark M. Eichelberger, director of the association. Mr. Eichelberger.
The Board of Directors of the American Association for the United Nations welcomes the distinguished guests who have joined with it in this dinner tonight. The association is an educational organization devoted to the support of the United Nations. We are very proud that the Honorable John Foster Dulles selected our association out of many invitations to deliver an important address on American foreign policy. Mr. Dulles has played a prominent part in the development of American foreign policy. He was at San Francisco as one of the architects of the United Nations. He has been a delegate to successive United Nations General Assemblies. As United States Senator and a close associate of some of the leaders of the Republican Party, he has taken an important part in developing such policies as the European Recovery Program, the North Atlantic Treaty, and the United Nations. Mr. Dulles.
Mr. Eichelberger and members of the American Association for the United Nations. Here tonight, you are carrying out our good custom of using the year end to think about the past in the hope that we can do better for the future. This year, it is particularly important to do that, and we should be grateful to all who, out of wisdom, experience, and proven idealism, helped to clarify the grave issues that confront us. As we look back, we need not, I think, feel despondent. There are great dangers ahead, and there are plenty of patches of ground fog. But if we lift our vision so that we see the present in the light of the long past, it is apparent that these post-war years have been years of achievement, and that our people have already surmounted at least one great peril. Now, nations are a good deal like individuals in the sense that while they may die a violent death, they're much more apt to die in their beds, particularly as they grow older. And the great question of our time has been whether our Western civilization has become so old and decadent that it was bound to pass away, giving place to the younger barbaric society born out of the unholy union of Marxist communism and Russia's imperialism. For 1,000 years, our Western civilization has been dominant in the world. It won and it held leadership on merit. It produced spiritual, intellectual, and material richness such as the world had never known before. The fruits of Western society went everywhere, and the people elsewhere wanted to share those fruits rather than to destroy their source. However, 1,000 years is a long time, even for a civilization. And many felt that Western civilization had run its course and had become infected with the same decay as had rotted the other great civilizations of the past. And the communists shouted that everywhere. The West, they said, could no longer produce the vital leadership and the creative acts needed to satisfy the dissatisfied masses. Only communism, they said, could now do that. And with that slogan, they softened up the opposition, and then they moved in country after country with terrorism, subversion, and civil war to gain political control. And by those methods, the Russian state and the Bolshevik Party, working hand in hand, brought under its control about 800 million people. And that's about one-third of all the people that there are. And still they were rolling on toward their announced goal of a communist one world. Who was there to stop them? Many thought that they were unstoppable, and a bandwagon trend was getting underway. And at this decisive moment in the history of the world, a heavy responsibility fell upon the United States. We were still a relatively young nation. We had not been devastated by war. And on that account, we were less susceptible than some other nations to the poison that the Communist Party distills. If anyone could perhaps demonstrate the faith and works needed to rally men to the cause of human freedom, it had to be the United States. And the whole world watched to see. And if at that juncture we had sought only to save ourselves, that would have been a public confession that the communists were right when they said that the West had rotted. The tide of communism would have rolled on irresistibly, and we ourselves would have been encircled, isolated, and finally engulfed. Only as we sought to help others could we save ourselves. And our people responded to that challenge with a 5-year record of which we can be proud. Let me mention a few of the deeds. We showed by example within our own country that social justice could be had without traveling the communist road of violent revolution and materialism. Through graduated income and estate taxes and social security and pension plans, our capitalistic society has come to approach much more closely than any communist society the ideal of production according to ability and distribution according to need. Take the colonial system. Within 5 years, that system, which had become a festering sore, was subjected to orderly liquidation. Over 750 million people within these 5 years have won political independence. Great Britain, as the principal colonial power, took the lead. Our own direct national contribution was the granting of independence to the Philippines and the discrediting of racial discrimination here at home. And in many other ways, however, we have helped in this whole great process of building between men of different races, creeds, and colors a new relationship of partnership and of equality. And again, since the end of World War II, we have provided in loans and grants over $40 billion for the relief of other peoples and the reconstruction of other lands. And thereby we have practiced the great commandment that the strong ought to lighten the burdens of the weak. We took the lead in founding the United Nations as an organization for recording the moral judgments of the world and for developing ways to put power behind those judgments so as to promote collective justice and security. This year, for the first time in all time, a world organization moved with force to halt aggression. It seemed that the hope of ages had at last come true. And whatever may be the disappointments of the present, we can know this, that the sons of the United Nations, who in Korea lay down their lives, are doing so for the noblest cause for which men ever died in battle. They have done the indispensable by showing that world order is a practical possibility, and nothing now can stop the determination of the peoples of the world to move on to achieve solidly that goal. Now, I do not claim for a moment that our national record is one of perfection or anything like perfection. Our own social changes may have gone so far as unduly to curtail incentive and self-reliance. In some cases, political independence may have been given to peoples so inexperienced in the ways of self-government that it will be hard for them to preserve that independence in the face of the diabolically clever apparatus of Soviet communism. Our loans and grants to others may sometimes have provided mere temporary relief rather than have been incentives to bold new creations of unity and strength. Both our own country and the United Nations may have assumed political responsibilities which they did not yet have the power to back up. Policies themselves good often lacked efficient and timely execution. There have been grave and perhaps unnecessary setbacks, and almost surely the free world has erred in relying too much upon potential power and in not creating enough military strength in being. There's no occasion for complacency nor for whitewash. It is quite in order to expose errors and to point the way to making better use of all the moral and material assets which our people have shown they could provide. Such constructive pressures are needed, and I have tried to be among those who sought to create them. Under our political system, that is a special responsibility of the opposition party. But whatever may have been the faults and inadequacies of leadership, our people over the past 5 years have wrought mightily and not without result. I recall reading a year ago Moscow's leading editorial, which welcomed in the year 1950. And it welcomed it with these words: "The forces of the Soviet camp are multiplying day by day, and today include the great Soviet Union, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Bulgaria, Romania, Hungary, Albania, Northern Korea, the Mongol People's Republic, the Chinese People's Republic, and the German Democratic Republic." And the editorial concluded, "Communism is conquering. Communism will triumph." I don't know what Investi is going to say next Monday in greeting the year 1951. But I do know this, that whereas between 1945 and 1950 it was boasting new conquests at the average rate of over two nations a year and over 150 million people a year, there are this year no new names of which they can boast, no new names to put on that Izvestia list. Now, I do not predict that the end of Soviet communist expansion has come, but I do say that the free world has found the way to check its ability to expand by cheap methods short of open war. And to have done that is no mean accomplishment. Communism pitted its youth against what it thought was our decrepitude, its universal creed against what it thought was our isolationism, its revolutionary practices against what it thought was our static mood. And it found, to its dismay, a people who under pressure did not decompose into factionalism and frustration. Unitedly and with unpartisan and bipartisan leadership, they joined in an outpouring of compassion, fellowship, and material succor such as history had never before recorded. There is scarcely a man, woman, or child in the whole United States who has not consciously made some sacrifice out of the highest motives of which human beings are capable. And in the process, they have ennobled their own character, have given new hope and courage to millions elsewhere, and have discomfited the leaders of Soviet communism. There are defects at top and bottom, but the broad outline is not without a certain grandeur. It is not to be belittled, nor is the mood one to be reversed. We can rejoice in the renewal of the faith that has been the rock of our foundation and out of which have gushed healing waters. We can be confident that that faith, if sustained, and I say if sustained, assures our capacity to overcome at least one of the twin dangers which at the end of World War II confronted us. We are not doomed to die in our beds. But since it seems that the free world has gained a certain immunity from the Soviet Communist Party poison, now their leaders must decide whether or not to accept one of these waiting periods, which, to use Stalin's words, may from time to time be necessary to buy off a powerful enemy and gain a respite, or will they resort increasingly to open war? We must recognize that the very fact that the free world succeeded as fully as it had to slowing up communist success by methods short of war automatically increased the risk of war itself. But risk is not the same as certainty. And just as we surmounted in recent years the primary peril of inner decay, so in the year ahead, we must seek to surmount also the peril of full-scale foreign war. We must seek and find effective deterrents to Russian armed aggression. Now, moral factors do not weigh heavily in the Russian scale. So we're forced to think somewhat in material terms. And there we are not without some assets. Our inventive, resourceful, and free society has given us an industrial productivity far greater than that of Russia. In terms of steel, aluminum, electric power, and oil, the United States has a superiority of about 3 or 4 to 1 over Russia. That ratio, of course, would not hold good if Russia could take the industrial power of the Ruhr in Western Europe and the oil of the Middle East. But so long as there are impediments to that, the free world has an economic power which operates as a major deterrent to open Russian aggression, particularly if we also have the will to forego some of our pleasures and to put our economic machine into high gear, creating weapons on a mass production basis. Now, too, we have great possibilities of waging psychological warfare. Despotism, when you look at it from without, almost always looks solid and formidable. And when you look at the free societies, they usually look divided and weak. Actually, that's an optical illusion, because the reality is just the opposite. Take Russia. Out of its 200 million people, only about 6 million, or 3%, are members of the ruling Communist Party. And the political prisoners in Russia alone number from 10 to 15 million, or twice the total membership of the Communist Party. And in the party itself, you find it shot through with distrust and suspicion. And there are periodic purges between the party factions. And no one, not even in high authority, feels personally safe. And if you turn to the satellite countries, you find a situation even more precarious. For example, there is much unrest on the China mainland, and in Poland and Czechoslovakia and such countries, the people are forced to accept officials of Russian nationality because the Russian masters cannot find any Poles or Czechs that they're willing to trust. Now, when a few men rule despotically 800 million, you can be very sure that many of the 800 million are sullen, resentful, and eager for change. And the others will have been so beaten into submissiveness that they will have lost all sense of personal responsibility. They just wouldn't find it possible to respond to the unpredictable needs which come out of the disruptions that war creates. War can be very unkind to rulers who are despots and who have systematically destroyed the individual initiative of their people. The leaders know that, and we can increasingly help them to see the light. When it comes to straight military strategy, the free world seems momentarily in a mood of some confusion and without any agreed deterrent program. The Soviet Union has interior lines, It is concentrated men, tanks, artillery, and strategic and tactical planes around the hub of the great circle of its control. And the rim of this circle starts near the North Pole and swings south along the border, Norway, Finland, Sweden, West Germany, Austria, and Yugoslavia, and then east along the borders of Greece, Turkey, the Arab states, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, Burma, Indochina, and Malaya, and then running northward close to the Philippines, Formosa, Japan, Korea, and Alaska. And from within this vast orbit, a single will can in secrecy plot and act to strike in any direction any one of many nations with overwhelming force. Now, it may be possible by prearranged defense to make that attack costly, particularly where sea and air power play a role, and where, as in Western Europe, there is depth, numbers, and military experience on which to draw. But with more than 20 nations strung along the 20,000 miles of Iron Curtain, it is not possible to build up static defensive forces which could make each nation impregnable to such a major and unpredictable assault as Russia could launch. To attempt this would be to have strength nowhere and bankruptcy everywhere. That is a clear conclusion, but it does not mean, as some people seem to think it means, that we must therefore abandon the whole idea of collective security and merely build up our own home defense area with the help of such other countries as we might pick because of their capacity to be useful to us. The whole world, I know, can be confident that the United States is not at a moment of supreme danger going to shed allies who are endangered and to whom we are bound by solemn treaty, by common heritage, and by past fellowship in war and peace. I do not interpret anyone as urging this. And any nation that did that would certainly not be in a position thereafter to do much picking and choosing for its own account. It would have elected a dangerous course, for solitary defense is never impregnable. You can plan on paper what it seems ought to be an impregnable defense, a China wall, a Maginot line, a Rock of Gibraltar, an Atlantic and Pacific moat. But the mood that plans such a defense carries within itself the seeds of its own collapse. A defense that accepts encirclement quickly decomposes. That has been proved 1,000 times. A United States that could be an inactive spectator while the barbarians overran and desecrated the cradle of our Christian civilization would not be the kind of a United States which could defend itself. Now, fortunately, we don't have to choose between two disastrous alternatives. It is not necessary either to spread all our strength around the world in futile attempts to create everywhere a static defense, nor did we crawl back into our own hole in the vain hope of defending ourselves alone against all the rest of the world. We're not so bankrupt in resourcefulness that we can find only these two choices. There are others. Around the rim of the captive world, the free world can maintain enough economic and political vigor, enough military strength, and enough will to resist so that these areas cannot be cheaply conquered by subversive methods, by trumped-up civil wars, or even by satellite attacks. That leaves to be dealt with the possibility of a full-scale attack by the Soviet Union itself. And against that, there is only one effective defense for us and for others. That is the capacity to counterattack. The existence of that capacity is the ultimate deterrent. When I was in the Senate working for the ratification of the North Atlantic Pact, I then took the position that that pact did not commit the United States to land defense of any particular area, that it did commit us to action, but action of our choosing rather than action that an aggressor could dictate to us. In Korea, the United Nations forces are suffering a grave handicap trying to repel an aggressor within the limited area that he selects for an attack, at the time he selects, and with methods of war which are dictated by the terrain and the weather he selected. Our people have loyally, sacrificially, and rightly backed this historic first attempt at organized suppression of aggression. But we instinctively feel that there is something wrong about the method, and we do not want to be committed to a series of Koreas all around the globe. That instinct is a sound instinct. Against such military power as the Soviet Union can marshal, collective security depends upon capacity to counterattack against the aggressor. Then there can be concerted rather than dissipated power, for the force that protects one protects all. And with that, there is a good chance of deterring aggression. The free world is not without power in this respect. It has a strategic air force and a stock of weapons. But total reliance should never be placed on any single form of warfare or any relatively untried type of weapon. We have naval power and potential strength on the ground. Much more of all of this is needed. The arsenal of retaliation should include all forms of counterattack with maximum flexibility, mobility, and the possibility of surprise. The place of assembly of this should be chosen not as places to defend, but as suitable stages for launching the means of destroying the forces of aggression if aggression occurs. The United Nations, if it shows the moral courage that is needed, should be given the right to determine the fact of aggression so as to ensure the charter goal of armed force not being used save in the common interest. In such ways, the idea of collective security can be given sensible and effective content. It is not pleasant at this holiday season to talk about instruments of death. But events in Korea have shown that peace is not to be found in an unbalance of military power. And to correct that balance is a grim necessity. But it is a necessity which also requires that we shall be vigilant to preserve and not relax the moral safeguards with which military power always needs to be surrounded. We can rejoice that the United Nations forces in Asia and the North Atlantic forces in Europe are under the command of two men, General MacArthur and General Eisenhower, who have demonstrated in peace and war that they put material values second and moral values first. And that should be the mood of all our people. It is not easy to do what has to be done without whipping up emotions that are themselves provocative of war. That we must not let happen. And so my final word to you is this. Let us all, on the eve of this new year, solemnly consecrate ourselves to that calm resolve which in moments of peril is a hallmark of true greatness.